You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Leonard Michels, the author most recently of a novel, Sylvia, published by Mercury House. It follows from a selection from his journals called Shuffle, published recently by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. He's the author as well of two books of short stories, Going Places and I Would Have Saved Them If I Could, as well as an earlier novel called The Men's Club. Several of his recent stories have appeared in the Best American Short Stories anthologies, as well as the Best American Essays. You commented in the essay on Gilda and Rita Hayworth that appears in the current Best American Essays volume that humiliation seems like an important subject in film as well as in fiction and stories as well. And it seems as if Sylvia has deep at its core a sense of personal humiliation. And I wondered if you could begin by talking about that.
Well, it's certainly present in the book. And there is, in fact, a scene in the book where the idea of humiliation and, in a sense, our unconscious relation to it is crystallized. In this particular scene, the narrator is driving to work with a colleague and a friend, and the friend who's driving is gay, and he likes to tell the narrator what he does in his social life and in his erotic life. And the narrator, who is fairly innocent, that doesn't know a hell of a lot about the world, listens to these stories with a great deal of fascination. And one day, the guy driving him to work says that he knows somebody who was asked by his lover to wear braces because it turned them on. In any event, the narrator then says something like, I don't remember the exact words, but he says something like, who would do that? Well, the irony is, of course, that the narrator is living a life that is far more degraded and, indeed, self-humiliating. But at this very moment, he's completely unconscious of it and, struck by this story as if it had no relation to himself.
I remember when I first started reading you, there was a quality in many of the stories of a kind of, what would you say, reptilian nastiness that seemed to animate, be the fire that created the fiction. And I know to some extent in my life as a man, Philip Roth talks about looking for a woman with whom the relation would be exigent. He says he wanted an Anna Karenina. He wanted a tragic figure. He felt that this would help his work. Was there that for you as well, the feeling that fiction itself begins in some way in degradation?
Well, that's an interesting suggestion. I don't know that I ever explicitly thought about it that way, but I have noticed, of course, in my own life that that stories are very often inspired by situations where there is degradation of somebody, and it's really rather like what you find to be the case in many, many jokes. I think storytelling is a version of telling a joke in a way. That is, say, a similar structure, and the impulse is often very much the same kind of liberation issues from telling a story as from telling a joke. And if you'll notice, many, many jokes really are about degradation, humiliation, some sort of shocking, coming down in the world.
I often felt when I was reading D.H. Lawrence that the writer was judging me for my sexual inexperience at the time. You've described this as an experience you had at different movies when you were young, of the material being in some way deeper than you were and causing shock waves in you afterwards. Is that one of the functions of literature for you?
I think in some sense maybe it is. Literature really, in a way, introduces one to oneself. And the experience of movies, I believe, is rarely as subtle, say, as the experience of a novel or a story. However, movies do also accomplish the same kind of thing. I have not thought this out in any systematic way, but I think it's fair to say, and I think I actually do believe that there's some kind of truth in writing, and the truth very often has to do with it lies in our own hearts and which is otherwise inaccessible to us. But when we read a book or a poem, what have you, we're open to ourselves quite suddenly, and the experience is thrilling and valuable and has an effect of edification.
Well, I've often found, you know, in preparing for the show, I reread this whole pile of books in front of me, and I experienced once again a series of shocks, you know, shrewdly administered shocks in the language of this fiction. And I began to think that I know how carefully you write. What is involved in constructing an irritant or a shock that will outlast its initial application?
Well, first of all, I think it's true of my work, at least I hope it's true of my work, that I don't write with the intention of having this or that effect on any particular audience. I have an idea or, if you like, a kind of vision, and I try to serve that so that every single word in any story or anything else I write is in some sense pointing always at the story itself. It's not reaching out to stir the reader, to shock the reader, to stimulate the reader in this way or that. Of course, it will, I hope, if the story is true to itself. It will have all of those effects. But it will never actually reach out off the page in order to have those effects. Am I clear? I hope I am.
I think so. In other words, that whatever my response of shock may be to the story has been constructed as a whole for its own values.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking not of the shock of the material, but of the shock of apt language. I remember in one of the essays, the essay called "I'm Having Trouble with My Relationship," you talk about something being as integral as the tongue of a shoe. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, all at once the pleasure of a surprise, a kind of surrealist surprise in the essay, as well as, yes, as common as shoes, but there was a kind of fetishism, a mm-hmm. kind of shoe fetishism entering into the phrase. And I thought, gee, this is as good on first reading as it is on the third. And I know that you've read stories aloud, and I guess I'm asking what makes language that at first seems novel, what gives it its lasting quality?
Well, I think, again, without having any kind of prepared and systematic view, I think there is a relation between the language you use and whatever it is that you're writing about. And the relation between them is very subtle, and you very often have to calibrate your language the way you... you know, you measure things in a chemistry lab. That is to say, you may think of a really wonderful image for something or other, but the adequacy of the image it may not be right. It may exceed the requirements of the subject at hand, so that you do indeed get a shocking effect, if you like, and then it doesn't last. It won't survive over time. If, however, the relation to what it is you're talking about is exactly right, I think will live forever.
There's a hilarious sentence at the end of the author's note in the Best American Essays for 1992. It says of this book, Sylvia, forthcoming in the fall of 1992 is Sylvia, a novel based on his first marriage. It's sort of like a musical based on Damon Runyon's stories. What is it to have gone back to this material and to have shaped it after its appearance as an autobiographical memoir and shuffle into a novel?
Well, a great deal is involved, aside from certain kinds of emotional difficulty. I waited 30 years before I wrote one word about this. And when I did write it, and it first appeared in Vanity Fair, I was pretty much satisfied with it. And then I rewrote it a great deal and reprinted it in Shuffle. And then I decided, for the purposes of this book, Sylvia, I decided to expand it in a certain way. And I wanted to include a great deal about the era, the early 60s, and I wanted to say a good deal about New York in the early 60s. And part of my motivation had to do with taking what was essentially a kind of lyric or almost poetic form, the first versions, I mean, and democratizing it. That is to say, making it, in some sense, available to a lot more people than had been the case in the first versions. I wanted to try to suggest, in some sense, that what I am talking about in regard to my first marriage is not exclusively my experience. That is very likely the experience of thousands of other people then and now. And for this reason, I felt it was necessary to redo a great deal of the original effort. And as you can see, it's about three times the size that it once was. And I talk a lot about what was happening in the streets and in the nightclubs and in politics and in the early 60s, as well as talking a very great deal about the intimacies of that marriage.
The woman in the book, Sylvia, is to some extent hysteric. And as such, in a way, she characterizes those times. That is to say, I think we all knew then people we would be unwilling to know now because their hysteria seemed interesting to us and also characteristic of the period we were living in. Can you talk about that sense? Because it is so much a sense of what people thought about literature then, too.
You know, this in a way is the most difficult question to respond to, because in the moment, at any particular time, during any era, I think we live in a state of I don't want to say desperate, but that word keeps coming to mind, desperate blindness. That is to say, we don't know what's going on. We don't really know who we are. We don't know the degree to which we're self-possessed or possessed, as it were, by forces external to ourselves, such forces as the radio or the newspapers or movies or how our friends behave. We don't know. And that's, in a way, what the case was with Sylvia and with me and with a lot of my friends. A lot of people then that I knew were very much involved with drugs, for example. And at the same time, they were very seriously committed to a life of literature, of language, of words, and so on. And there were kinds of things going on then that really I don't think go on any longer. For example, I was very often in rooms where people literally talked for hours and hours about literary matters. They would talk about Shakespeare's sonnets or Gulliver's Travels, and they'd be all in there smoking grass. And you'd sit in this living room, and you'd hardly leave your chair, and suddenly dawn would light the windows and so on. And I believe we thought there was no other way to live, no other way to spend your time there was nothing so valuable as what we had just done. I don't remember a word of those conversations, but in some sense, we were living in the minute. We were living in a way that we felt was consistent with the age, you know, the moment in history. And we felt as if we were some sort of spiritual avant-garde.
Do you miss those conversations?
I miss them tremendously.
I do, too. What I've been wondering, I can understand how people who didn't grow up with them would never have known of their existence and how other forms, say, television, radio, the rest of it, the immediacy of everything, could supplant them. What I don't see is how so many people who did grow up in those times can have lost that appetite or that aptitude for, you know, what, thrilling tergiversation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea about what happened?
Well, I don't know that I can say exactly what happened, except that when things change all around you, when the changes are so tremendous, for example, the kind of attention now given to movies, the kind of attention given to music, the fact that you sometimes can hardly find a restaurant to have lunch in where there isn't a significant amount of noise in the air. The need, as it were, that so many millions of people seem to have for, you know, some sort of continuous sound in their heads that comes from outside. All of this argues against the possibilities of conversation. It furthermore, I think, at a deeper level, argues against the possibilities of thought. And apparently, there's something in the air right now which makes people very reluctant to sit quietly and think about one thing at all. They seem almost perhaps to be afraid of the kind of loneliness that might be entailed by actually thinking quietly about your own life. There are many other factors, I think, to be considered, all of which would bear on this question of literary conversation. There was a time when these things really were not so much in our consciousness. There was not so much in the way of general noise, loud music everywhere, the continuous, you know, sense of movies crashing in on your consciousness in one way or another. Television wasn't really so powerfully developed. And I think in a curious way also the popularity of the psychological institutions had not, you know, peaked the way it has in recent times. That is to say, people didn't feel every time they might have some distress in their lives, the necessity of running to see a psychotherapist and talk it all out. A lot of things. I'm not sure that any one of these things is really terrifically significant. I am conscious only of a kind of convergence of a lot of different elements in modern culture, recent modern culture, which to my mind seem to argue against conversation, to make conversation seem literary conversation, long, deep, serious literary conversation, seem to make it not merely unfashionable but virtually embarrassing.
I have a somewhat aligned idea about this. It's a slightly odd one. You know, in Sylvia, and by the way, I'm talking to Leonard Michaels, whose most recent book, Sylvia, has been published by Mercury House. In Sylvia, your father upbraids you at a certain point. He says, "You're talking this way to the mommy." And he calls your mother the mommy. And I remember similar embarrassing and tender things that I heard around my own house. And I think about my parents and how single-minded they were about, and are, about whatever it is they are. You know, it may be ridiculous to me, but they are thoroughly immersed in these acts of life that yield phrases like, "How dare you talk to the mommy that way?" It doesn't sound ridiculous to them. I think in a certain way, we grew up so aware of the ridiculousness of the previous generation that we began to think, what will we be seen as? How will we sound to others? And irony was perhaps the first protection against seeming ridiculous, the refusal to participate entirely in what one is saying. And then, afterwards, a refusal of intense commitment, as if the way in which you might come to seem to be a joke to someone later has to be safeguarded against right now. I see it all the time, you know. It's as if, you know, the love of ideas or books or language, we know it isn't cool for a brief moment, and you describe it in the in seeing Lenny Bruce perform. There was a moment in which, you know, that kind of sensibility was hip and it had a fashionable repulsiveness of its own. But I think something, you know, disappeared, and we now will do anything to prevent ourselves becoming passé. And so the result is we've become, I think, bland.
Well, I think what you say has the ring of truth about it. The exact stages by which these changes occurred, I couldn't begin to describe them, except to say that I thought I heard something in your account. In some way, when you give up the kind of identification that your parents had, when you decide that that's not for you, when you're not merely going to live a life of such singularity where you are clearly one thing, where you are the mommy, you are the daddy. Once you give that up, it's very hard then to turn around and embrace it once more. In some way, once you give it up, you betray it, you take a stand, and you then call your own integrity into question if you, you know, decide later, indeed, you want to be the mommy or the daddy. It becomes very, very hard to reverse yourself and to see, you know, late in life. It's very hard to deal with the pain of recognizing how good they were.
In addition to reading Sylvia, I read the short story called Viva la Tropicana that appeared in the Best American Short Stories of 1991, the volume edited by Alice Adams. And as I was just saying to you before the story, before the show began, I think the story is really one of the funniest and lively extravaganzas I've come across. It really has a kind of roller coaster effect that's very, you know, enjoyable. And you were saying that you weren't sure that you would get back to it and let it be what was announced at some earlier point as an adventure novel. I want to, you know, express the hope that you will, but I wondered if you could talk about, since, you know, Sylvia is in a sense 30 years in the making, that period between conception and execution, and what happens in the course of shaping a piece of work.
Well, in the course of working particularly on Sylvia, let me just say that there were occasions when I thought I would write it, and I tried, and I'd write 5-10 pages and throw it away. There was something basically wrong with it, and I would lay it aside and not go back to it for a long, long time. Eventually, after 30 years had passed, I found it in myself, you know, to get this thing going. As for a story like Viva la Tropicana, that was pure joy, and it was very, very easy to write. It was so easy to write that I mistrusted it every minute. And when the story was praised and reprinted in Best American Stories, I was completely delighted, but it was a special kind of delight. It was like, you know how happy you feel when you tell a joke to your friends and they all burst out laughing? It makes you very happy when they do. That's how I felt in regard to that story. As for the shaping of it, the struggle to write it, it was minimal. The story just flew down the page.
Having that kind of happy accident, can it be returned to?
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubt, that I will go on with it, and it will become a novel, and Maybe indeed in the writing of it, I'll feel the same kind of happiness again. The trouble is, with me, not with anybody else necessarily, but if there's certain pressures in my life that get me kind of low, it's very hard to find the spirit required to write that kind of a story.
Well, you know, there's a moment that I always think of in this regard. In Great Expectations, at one point, Joe Gargery talking about the epitaph that he's written for his father. Joe Gargery is a blacksmith, and he says of the epitaph that he wrote it as easily as bending a nail. And when you read Great Expectations, you have the feeling that Dickens wrote it with that kind of joy, that there was something absolutely natural. Mm-hmm. It was a habitual action for him, and it came out easily and perfectly. And that's the kind of thing that you rarely find. I get the sense in your stories that much more is slowly developed and the result of painstaking. I won't say joyless, because much of it is very funny, but very great toil.
Which one now? Are you talking about Sylvia or the Tropicana?
Sylvia, and in general, I think of the stories, and I would have saved them if I could, as being many of them the result of a lot of thought, revision, rewriting, reworking.
Well, that's absolutely the case. I revise much more than I write. I'm a fanatical rewriter. And the experience of words just pouring out in a very easy way, page after page, is hardly ever my experience. It was the case in Viva la Tropicana. Other writers have commented on it, by the way. Lord Byron says at one point in Don Juan, "I write as easily as I walk or ride." And, I wish I could say that that's been my experience in life. Unfortunately, it hasn't. My books are thin and terse and very careful.
I've been talking to Leonard Michaels, the author most recently of Sylvia, published by Mercury House. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.